back, pod people, to another episode of Cinema Demore. I am Justin Morgan, and I am here with
James Reinhardt,
Chuck Phillips,
and we're continuing our international horror discussion that we started last week with Nosferatu. And we're in Japan this week talking about Onibaba, which is from 1964. So we take quite a leap from 1922. We skip a couple decades there.
There was no good horror movies in between 1922 and 1964. That's a fact.
Maybe in America, but when you're looking outside of the bubble of America, it gets difficult. No, that's just how we landed. This is the film that 2 Decembers ago, December 2018, we picked the Japanese theme. I believe it was James's pick. And we each picked a movie within that theme. And our very, very last one, we decided to add a fourth discussion. And we all picked two movies and rolled the dice. And this was actually one of James's picks, but we ended up with James's other pick, Diary of a Fart, or whatever that movie was called.
I thought Onibaba was yours, because...
Oh, was it? I thought it was you, but...
I think my two were... I think one of mine was definitely Audition, and then I couldn't think of a second one, and I went with Zombie Ass as a joke, and that joke ended up going way too far, and we ended up doing an episode on Zombie Ass.
It's a real episode. Find it.
And Zombie Ass is a real movie, everyone. We are not the...
Don't find that.
I found it on Crunchyroll, which is an anime service. And I remember my wife being like, "What's Crunchyroll?" As if it was pornography or something. I'm like, "It's an anime thing." I had to use it to watch what is it called? I want to say Diary of Mad Ass or something.
Zombie Ass Toilet of the Living Dead.
Yeah, I had to watch Zombie Ass. Clearly not porn. Which,
you know, I guess that's a PSA from Justin. If you guys really want to watch Zombie Ass, Crunchyroll's the way to do it.
It's kind of bad, but entertaining. Doing it over something like Onibaba is a little disappointing, but it was an interesting episode. It was an interesting way to close out the year.
Yeah, I remember because I was hoping Onibaba would be the one that was picked because I wanted to see it, and it wasn't. So I just saw it on my own because I realized I could do that. But I really liked it. I was like, man, I would have liked to have talked about this over Zombie Ass, but here we are, you know.
Yeah, I had a huge Japanese film kick this year, which you have to keep hearing me talk about because that's all I did this year. Though I didn't get into too many movies like this that had the folklore. Maybe like four movies altogether, and they're kind of close to coming out all around the same time. Chuck, did you watch any more? I know you were watching the like sister film. What is it?
Kureneko
or whatever.
Yeah, I watched that. I watched Quiet Anne, which is the anthology film. And I did rewatch House, which is still my favorite Japanese horror movie of all time. Because it's just pure insanity.
Yeah, I think that's pretty close to it as far as I can remember watching folklore at all. I have bought a book on folklore based off of a recommendation from Guillermo del Toro. I didn't dive into it yet, but I was kind of interested in the stories. I found the story that this movie is based off of, and it's so loose. And I think it's just kind of what happens with folklore to begin with. It just changes so much over time that it's quite a different story when it comes out. Mm-hmm. But, and I also have a feeling I can't pronounce any Japanese because I say everything completely different. Like, I thought it was like Kureneko, and I've always said Quaden. I don't know. House. I can agree on House, though.
Randy Quaden? Is that who you're thinking of?
No, Dennis Quaden. Jeez.
Okay.
There can only be one Quaden.
Yeah, exactly. That's really rude, Chuck.
To assume you're Quaden's.
Yes. I don't know. I haven't a clue. But I don't know. I've been interested in getting into the Japanese folklore and just kind of reading those old tales and just seeing how they compare to like our kind of like Grimm's fairy tales and stuff that I've been exposed to my whole life. This is actually kind of interesting. This particular movie, because I don't 100% know what to consider it. My mind wants to call it a ghost story, though there technically are not ghosts in it. It just kind of has that haunting atmosphere throughout the whole movie. And I don't know, maybe I feel like I'm lying to people, but when they're like, what's it about? I'm like, ah, it's like a ghost story with no ghosts.
Yeah, it's a horror film, but yeah, I don't know what category I would put it in. Maybe, I mean, not even like it's about demons, but not really.
Not real demons.
I mean, you know, maybe ish. I mean, there's definitely something going on off that mask, but
there's something up for debate. It could be supernatural, but it also fits completely in the realm of being real.
James said it. It's a haunted mask movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the Goosebumps book, The Haunted Mask.
Mm-hmm. Goosebumps. Mm-hmm. Last week it was Are You Afraid of the Dark? We're really venturing out there, people.
I mean, when you kind of think about it, it is sort of similar to that old Goosebumps story, The Haunted Mask, where like she gets this mask and puts it on and then it won't come off. And, you know.
That kind of goes like towards like the climax of the movie, but like it could be the way that they build it up. The way she takes the mask on and she's able to take it off until it rains. So even though it is a curse, it might not be like an actual spiritual, like it's demonic and that's why it won't come off your face. It might literally be like, I don't know, this skin disease or whatever has rubbed off on you or activated from the rain, or was it just a very poorly designed mask that when it gets wet you can't get up your face?
Because there's obviously an implication that a big implication that the dude that she stole the mask off of, the guy she killed and took the mask from, that he was having the same problem, that he couldn't get it off. So, I mean, what I obviously we could all draw our own conclusions, but what I was taking from this was, that there was some sort of supernatural thing of this mask or some sort of curse of this mask. Or if you put it on and used it for nefarious reasons that it got stuck to your face.
Well, this is based off of a Buddhist tale. So I don't really know if it ties into the folklore or how old it is, but the story is called A Mask with Flesh Scared a Wife. That's the title of it. And it's about kind of similar. It's about a mother who's trying to stop her daughter from being like virtuous by frightening her with a mask on. But the daughter is so virtuous, she's not scared of it. But then Buddha punishes her by like making the mask stick to her face. And that comes into this film mostly towards the end of the film, maybe the last 40 minutes, if we're going to be nice, like the final third of the film. The rest of it has quite an interesting social commentary, I think. I don't even know if the whole movie's like horror. It just kind of, it has that atmosphere and then it shifts halfway through. I don't even know if you would think you were watching a horror film if you had no idea what it was about.
I mean, the beginning of it definitely seems like more of a character drama, dark. I'd say kind of a dark drama type of a feeling to it. And it's definitely got a very surreal atmosphere throughout the whole film. But then it obviously becomes more horror as the film progresses.
Yeah, it's the theme of survival. It's the whole movie is about survival, and that theme, I don't know if I really felt it so much in like Nosferatu, unless it's Nosferatu survival. But the theme of survival is like really, really, really strong here on out. Like all the movies I grew up with, all the slasher films and everything, it's just, maybe it's a different kind. You know, they're trying to outlast this killer. And these are people that are just living in like extremely difficult times. And it is about a mother and her daughter-in-law. And instead of, I guess, I don't know if it's really a moral high ground, but instead of resorting to prostitution, they resort to killing samurai and stealing their armor and selling it, weapons and armor, and selling it for basically nothing, barely making it by. And then everything kind of spirals out of control when, I guess, he's considered their neighbor, or at least their son slash husband's friend shows back up, and it seems like things are going to get easier, but things spiral out of control in the sense of this like lust and jealousy that also kind of finds its way into modern horror too very easily.
Yeah, it's you're definitely right about it being a film about survival, because these characters are doing whatever they need to do to survive. But to me, it also was a movie about loss too, where these characters have kind of lost their humanity in a way. Like they're just kind of scavengers where they're murdering people and stealing their shit. And then the older woman, she's lost her son who is married to the younger woman. Yeah, so they've both lost someone, and the younger woman, starts sleeping with the neighbor dude, who's a very skeevy dude, very creepy, but she's clearly sleeping with him to, deal with her grief, but also feel some sort of human touch again. And, the mother's, obviously jealous. I feel like there is some sexual frustration there, but the mother also just doesn't want to lose, the young woman. Like, she's her only companion. I think she's afraid of losing her to this dude. And, obviously he uses this mask to try and keep her, but in the process, she loses her humanity. So it is a film about survival and loss, I think.
Yeah, I can feel that too. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, there's more than just jealousy. There's the fear of losing that companionship. They keep talking about how old she is, but she doesn't really, I guess she's like 60 or something, but she doesn't really come off as like the old hag they make her out to be, besides her graying hair.
I'm not sure if that's just like a weird Japanese thing. Like the old aunt in house is also supposed to be like 80 years old, but I'm pretty sure it's just like a 30-year-old woman that they dyed her hair white. Like, I don't know if they just don't even hire actresses that are over a certain age, so when they need old women, they just get like young women and just make them up to look old.
I believe that this woman is like 59 at the time of filming, so she is apparently older, but she doesn't look like it.
I feel like in like those times, like, this doesn't seem to have a specific time period. It seems to take place in a general past, like a fantasized version of Japanese past. But I feel like in those days, like, women in their late 50s, early 60s were considered old women. So I thought that worked.
They basically are kind of getting fucked over left and right. They are like surviving this war that essentially summed up by Hachi, the friend, about, we don't even remember what we're fighting for at this point. And now that the war is starting to die down, the value of the armor and stuff that they've been killing for has become nothing. So now it's like, what do they do? There's a change that's coming, and how do they face it? And it's sort of like this mother's solution is to kind of use fear to keep everybody in line, and it backfires.
Yeah.
I also find that moment where like we finally meet the samurai general with his mask is like one of the eeriest things I've ever seen. It kind of reminds me of that similar feeling I had from watching, you know, When a Stranger Calls, where it's just like that uncomfortable conversation that two people are having. Like there's just more going on. I also think it's that the way that they use that mask, it has that still expression that never changes, but like it has that eerie feeling of the fact, like it has an eerie feeling that seems like its expression changes based on like the way the head moves.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just, I don't know, the strength, like also these people seem to be on top of their game, at least from the beginning of the movie, where they're kind of hunting samurai. Mm-hmm. Their guards never let down. So it's ultra creepy when that guy shows up and catches the mother off guard. And you don't know where this is going. You don't know if this is supernatural. You don't, at that point, you have no idea what is about to happen. And I mean, the one thing that we know is that they have this hole that they lead the samurai. Well, they don't always lead the samurai to, but they dispose of samurai bodies in at least. And at this point, you get that feeling like that's what she's doing. Like you kind of know 100% where she's going. And it's still creepy when they finally, she jumps over the hole and the samurai ends up falling down inside. And when she goes down in there, it's just eerie with all the bones. And they do that little jump scare where he like grabs her for, I don't know, a second, but he's still dead. And then, yeah, even when he's talking about how handsome he is and it would frighten, you know, like she wouldn't be able to handle it. She'd fall in love instantly. And he had that like that gross face, and that was kind of the warning, and for us the foreshadowing of maybe don't put that thing on your face, you know?
Yeah.
But I kind of like the tool that she got, where it's like, you know what? She tells the daughter that it's a sin, basically like premarital sex is a sin, and you're married still, kind of a thing. And I love how with no explanation too, they're able to get those like stylized shots of her like floating through the grass, which I would just take as the daughter-in-law's perspective, not actually what's happening.
Yeah, that's what I took it as. Like that's how the daughter-in-law saw it.
But yeah, I think that just like the tone's perfect. It does have that, I guess the moral of the story and more along the lines of, you know, you can't use fear to get what you want. I'm sure tons and tons of other themes too. I'm not the smartest of people, so I'm sure you can think of a couple other themes. But yeah, it's just, I can see how it's influenced so many different films. I saw something on IMDb's like trivia when I was looking up the names of the actors, and it said that William Friedkin made the face of the girl from The Exorcist look kind of based off this mask, and I guess I can see it, and I don't know how true that trivia is, but I was like, I
see it. Yeah, you can definitely see the influence, like a weird influence, at least for me. We all know how influenced by Japanese cinema Star Wars is, but them turning in the armor to the dude and him giving them like minuscule food rations really reminded me of Episode 7, Rey with that alien played by Simon Pegg. And that obviously a big influence that I thought, and I haven't seen this film, but there was that Stephen King movie that came out for Netflix last year, Into Tall Grass. And I really feel like he saw Anibaba and then came up with that idea for that story of just people lost in tall grass. This entire movie takes place in like this eerie field of tall grass.
There's something eerie about it. I mean, it's just blowing in the wind, but maybe it's just how the movie opens with these samurai that get speared by these women, that it's just such a deadly place. You don't want to be there.
Yeah. It's like, it's a great location, and like all the, every character seems to like live in like a hut or a hole inside this massive overgrown field. It really does add to like that sort of timeless feeling of it, where they're just kind of lost in this limbo, all these characters together.
Chuck, what are your thoughts? Like, what do you think's the most horrific aspect of this movie? Is it something psychological, or is it like the vicious way that they murder a dog in it?
Yeah, I was not prepared for dog murder. I didn't see that one coming. I think there's a similar line in this one and Kuroniko, that's the same director that he did 4 years later. That I don't know that a lot of Western audiences really know as much. Like, I think in the West, we think of samurais as like these noble warriors, and both of these films that they did very much try to portray that actually the samurais were kind of terrible people, and they usually just destroyed everything in their way and murdered people indiscriminately. Like, that's the way you almost can't feel bad when they're like killing these samurais that wander in. Cause like she tells the samurai general with the mask, like, well, you know, we wouldn't have to do things like that if you guys wouldn't like destroy the entire island and, you know, steal all the men from us to go fight in the war. Like, we wouldn't have to resort to being murderers and, you know, dumping people in a hole. We would just be farmers like we were before. And it's the same thing in Kuroniko, like the mother and daughter like lose their son because he goes to war, and that like ruins their lives.
I mean, I was going to say, even though it's not as harsh in Onibaba as it is in Kuroniko, it's, he still has that line about, you know, lead the way, woman, or I'll kill you. So they aren't really seen as honorable at all. Like, the Kurosawa samurai are not in his movies at all.
I mean, I feel like these are more historically accurate to begin with. Like, that's what I've read a lot of history about samurai. A lot of the things they talk about is like they're closer to this than they are to like the things that like Kurosawa and some of the other people have like kind of like immortalized samurai as being like these great noble heroes. And they're like, no, they're actually usually a lot closer to the random guys that just like run through fields and like kill people and steal all their stuff, because there's no one really overseeing anything they do. And in Kuroniko, there's even the leader of the samurai like clan, I guess. Like, someone says, well, these ghosts hate samurai. And he was like, who could hate samurai? We're like the greatest people on earth. Like, it's pretty much exactly what he says. He's like, samurai are the greatest. How could anyone hate us? You're out of your mind if anyone hates samurai.
I haven't seen that movie in a while. That wasn't a part of my rewatch this year yet, which I might end up watching it soon. But it had something to do with like a bunch of samurai rape and murder the women, and then they make a deal with the devil essentially to become ghosts and kill samurai.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the themes are it's very similar to Onibaba. Like, the structure seems to be the same, because I think it's the same relationship of
mother and daughter-in-law.
Yeah, mother and daughter-in-law, and the son went off to war and hasn't come back, and they got to fend for themselves. But that was Shindo gets very atmospheric in this movie. I don't remember how many I've seen of his films, but I feel like these are the only two that are like his folklore stories. I saw The Naked Island, which is really good. Not horror at all, though. It is almost a completely silent film. It's just these people that live on this island and all this hard work that they do. And I guess that translates pretty well into Onibaba, because that's all these fucking people are doing. They're working their asses off the entire time. Makes me feel like a piece of shit.
Yeah, I think when I was looking him up, I think he only did I think those are the only two of his that are like what would be considered horror. I think the rest of his were like drama, more or less, or like, I think maybe some war films. Maybe
I don't know enough about some of these directors, so I was looking him up, And I know he worked with Mizoguchi on the 47 Ronin, which is like a super long, samurai film. And he, I guess that was his mentor. He was like a set designer and maybe a co-director for the 47 Ronin, but he doesn't seem too fond of the samurai. And actually, kind of interesting, this is happening, this movie happens during the Japanese New Wave, and from my understanding, it's like a decade or so, maybe even less, since the America, like, it's no longer like an American occupied Japan, and the censorship has lifted somewhat from after World War II. So they're being able to tell their stories. And from my understanding, Shindo was more focused on like the social issues that people dealt with, you know, based off of like the nuclear war, essentially, and like what these people were really going through. And clearly, and very clearly in this, sexuality, it's like, I don't know. And it, I take it as it's kind of has that theme of it's kind of a sin, but it also is like the nicest part of the movie. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's riddled with themes. I don't know if it's just because Shindo like had everything bottled up that he was never able to talk about, and he's like, I'm gonna put it all in Onibaba.
Well, it is interesting you mentioned you know, this is post American occupation Japan when they're putting out all these, you know, really interesting films. But this film is also, I mean, we talked a lot about a lot of Japanese cinema dealing with the fallout of World War II. I mean, Godzilla or Gojira is a big one, and this film's kind of tackling that as well, where it's, you know, the fallout of war and how it affects people who aren't even fighting in the war, and like how, you know, none of the samurai, none of the actual warriors seem to give a shit about the little people that are just struggling to make it through, you know, one day after another. All the samurai, you know, and the generals, of all they seem to care about is, you know, fighting in the war. But I definitely feel like that's how a lot of the people in Japan were probably feeling at the time, after two fucking bombs got dropped on them, you know, is that, you know, they probably felt like, you know, nobody really gave a shit about them.
No, absolutely. And I might be reaching, but the atmosphere that feels haunting just feels like, you know, we're haunted by all this stuff. That's very, very big generalization, but that's like the vibes I'm getting from the movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always bring back to Gojira, but Gojira is such a haunting film because it's looking at, you know, the death toll and this giant unstoppable thing that just shows up out of the ocean and destroys everything in its path. And this is definitely like the haunting, like, you know, wars ravaged our, you know, our entire way of life. And, you know, we've had to resort to doing terrible things to survive, like murdering people and dumping them in a fucking hole. And, you know, obviously all these characters, you know, they're, I mean, the setting I feel like is very deliberate, where they're, you know, kind of lost in this giant field and they, you know, rarely see other people except to murder other people. Then they get this outsider that comes in and they're all just kind of desperate for like some sort of human touch and human companionship. But also they've all, you know, I mean, you see, we see the daughter and the dude kind of rediscovering their humanity, but the mom is trying to preserve her own, but in doing so become, she literally, you know, is at the end chasing around her, you know, the daughter-in-law screaming that, you know, I'm human, I'm not a demon.
Yeah, I mean, and she's fighting change like head on.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about the feminist angle in this film? Actually, kind of goes to both Chuck. Because Kirneko is so similar to this. They have female protagonists, and through their lens, not all, but men are consistently the threat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because, and like we said, it's both films kind of play out almost like exact opposites. Like this film is the mother and daughter-in-law have struggled and survived. In the other one, they just get absolutely murdered and their house gets burned down and they have to get revenge from the grave. But I think it's interesting. It's an interesting look at the whole idea of, you know, like I said, they took in both films, it's that somebody came through and took the son who was like their sole provider away from them. I think it's interesting in Oni Baba, you talk about like how they all live in the tall grass, but I almost wonder, was it always all tall grass like that? Or would the men have like farmed it down to nothing that you could actually see what was going on? Is the entire setting like a result of the fact that there aren't any more men around and it's just these two women trying to do everything and they don't even have enough people or tools to do any of the farming, let alone cut down all the grass to be able to see anything. So is the entire, you know, atmosphere because of a lack of men? I don't know if he gets into like trying to say that, like, I don't want to say that he's saying like that women need men or that there needs to be like a union. That almost seems like in Oni Baba, like I agree with James, that guy's pretty creepy and, you know, maybe a little bit weird to hit on your best friend's wife just because he's dead. But I don't know if it's it's like her seeking out that, you know, she just wants to feel something again. She's dead inside because she hasn't had anyone to love in so long.
I think if anything, the movie definitely shows that it goes back to the survival idea. They definitely don't need the men. You know, the men seem to be always a problem.
Yeah, they're the ones that are ruining things more often.
They're the ones that are making things harder, for sure. It's their war, essentially. The one guy that they trade stuff with is a scumbag and, you know, not giving them the equivalent of what they need to survive, even though, like, their morals and ethics have gone down a giant hole, I guess. they've been doing all this stuff to survive, and then you even get the friend where his intentions might not be terrible. I mean, besides lusting after one of the women, but he kind of you could say the mother is just as guilty as destroying that relationship. But what are your thoughts on it, James?
It's interesting. It goes without saying that this movie, at the time it came out, would definitely not be an American film. obvious reasons. The nudity is one thing, but I do feel like there is definitely some sort of feminist subtext. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it definitely does seem to. I agree with you that a large part of the story is that, you know, men are making things worse. And, you know, these women have to do terrible things now to survive in this world that man has destroyed. And, even at the end, it's another dude that, like, makes things fucking worse when he kills the other guy. So, yeah, I do think it's, you know, I definitely don't think it's it's definitely not a, you know, oh, these women are terrible story. It's definitely looking at them as, like, just having to deal with the shitty hand that they're dealt. But, you know, it's always the male characters who are escalating things and making it worse.
Yeah. Do you think that it is, like, do you think that they have any hope for redemption?
I don't know. I feel like... I really like this movie. I feel like it just does kind of end. But ultimately, at the end of the day, like, the mom didn't really, you know, she was making it worse, but, you know, she didn't, at the end, she didn't kill the other dude. It was like that random thief. So I do feel like it, you know, eventually they could dig themselves out of this hole. See what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
But it would take a lot of work, for sure. I feel like most people aren't beyond redemption if you give them a shot. But
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of, it has that wonderful, I always love like a good ambiguous ending. Mm-hmm. This film ends ambiguously, where the potential of the mother or mother-in-law, however you want to view her, she either lives or dies, and you don't know. You things could be fixed where they end up working things out and they are able to survive together again, or she ends up being the cause of her own demise.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, whatever happens, that relationship is forever kind of, you know, tainted, because, you know, even though, because, like, you know, that the guy that caused all this trouble was murdered by some random dude. So I feel like, you know, whatever happens after the end of this movie, the mom and the daughter-in-law aren't really going to, you know, patch things up.
What do you think, Chuck? A chance of redemption? Is there one?
I kind of, like, I know it kind of, it ends ambiguously, I guess, but I took it as more than likely, like, at least the way it played out in my mind was that she died and the guy died, and then it's just that girl, like, left on her own pretty much. I don't know. Maybe my mind's just more depressing than anybody else. It's like, I recognize it as an ambiguous ending, but my brain automatically was like, no, that old woman definitely died and that girl's by herself now.
I see it the same way, because I see the movie as a tragedy. Like, I don't see things getting better. I see things, like, building up to a boiling point where everything just gets worse.
Yeah.
Maybe that's my view of life, but I try not to be pessimistic. But yeah, it's just kind of interesting how it all plays out. You basically have the mother that has this plan to keep the daughter-in-law to herself, essentially, and it backfires when that mask ends up getting stuck to her face. And I guess it doesn't really matter why it stuck to her face. But it is her punishment for the bad, terrible things that she's done. And I just, like, there's that idea of redemption, but it's just an idea. Like, we don't get any sort of resolution, which I think is ultimately why this movie ends up being considered a horror film in my mind, is that's it. Yeah, we ruin ourselves, or we can ruin ourselves if we're not careful.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, there's a supernatural element, but at the end of the day, like, people are still, you know, the ones doing the shitty things. Like, the mask didn't make the mom do what she was doing. She was doing it and just using the mask. So, yeah, like I said, it's one of those things where, like, people are still the monsters. They're just using the supernatural as a tool to make that happen.
And the mask is great for posters.
It is, yeah.
it's a great way to make you want to see them. See the movie.
I shouldn't say this, you know, seeing how we spent this entire podcast talking about the plot of the film, but this film really does work well if you go in not knowing anything. Because I went in knowing that it was called Onibaba Demon Woman. And I was kind of like, it was kind of like a ride for me, because I'm like, all right, what's happening now? How is this, you know, who's the demon woman? How is she, you know, what's her deal? And, you know,
who's the demon woman? What is her deal? That's the tagline on the poster.
That should be it. Who's the demon woman? What's her deal? But yeah, I was, because at first I'm like, oh, okay, this is like a murder type thing. But then it went a lot of different ways that I didn't know it was going to go. And I think that was because I didn't really know anything of the plot. I feel like, you know, like a lot of films, you know, not just this one, it's really effective when you go in as cold as possible.
I mean, the tension is crazy in this movie. Like, that shot where Hachi's there, like, eating the food with him, and the mother stare down, like, it reminds me of, you know, spaghetti westerns. They just unflinching, staring at each other and it doesn't feel like it's good. Although they don't kill him off the bat, and they get this information that the that their son slash husband has died. It sounds like at the hands of farmers, and there's kind of that duality too of what they've been doing. They've basically who they've been waiting to return has been killed, kind of somewhat in the same manner that they've been killing people. It's like another punishment too for the things that they've done. They were sinners, and they've, this is the way that they chose to go about solving their problems, and it's essentially what kind of kills their loved one.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's like a lot of horror films. It's an ironic punishment, you know, is they're doing all these things to survive until their loved one gets back, and he's killed in a, you know, a way that they've been killing other people. Like a lot of horror films, there's always an ironic comeuppance for these characters.
Yeah, it has that, like, things that you enjoy are a sin and you deserve to be punished for them. Because the world that, I mean, and it's not even the same as what we grew up with, because these people are working their asses off to live from day to day. And the stuff that we've grown up with, like from the slasher generation, has been more along the lines of, like, I don't know, I want to experience sex. And there's some outside force that's like, if you want to experience it, that's fine, but you got to deal with me.
It is interesting, like, look at slasher movies and modern day horror films where they did. You know, unintentionally take on this puritanical, oh, if you have sex, you'll die subtext, where, you know, Halloween was kind of the one to start it. And if you listen to John Carpenter, he was like, you know, that wasn't my intention. I just wanted to give the teenagers something to do, you know, while we're waiting for the killer to attack. And that was what he gave it, was, you know, sex. And
it's a great way to be distracted.
It is, yeah, exactly. You're distracted having sex. You don't know that this masked killer is lurking in the shadows. But yeah, obviously, you know, cinema and the World Journal kind of took that and ran with it and unintentionally set up this, oh, if you have sex, you're going to be punished with death.
Chuck, do you have any more thoughts?
I think I've said everything about this film, at least. I think Japanese horror in general is very interesting, because I think a lot of it's a society thing, like how we're bringing up the moral reason for murder. But a lot of Japanese society is based a lot on just in general, like a moral code and kind of a respect. Like there's a built-in respect for, usually, you know, your elders and things of that sort. So it's interesting. I just think Japanese horror in general is very, very unique, and that it's not like a lot of other countries. A lot of other countries, obviously, I feel like have a lot more influence from Western horror films or drama films. But like Japanese folklore, like especially something like Quaidan's very interesting. Of just like one of the stories in that one is a guy gets killed by a demon, and this other guy witnesses it, and she tells him, you know, never tell anybody about this or I'll kill you. And you're like, okay. And then he has like a very happy life and everything's normal, and then he tells his wife about the night a demon almost killed him, and she's like, that sound familiar to you?
Oh wait, yeah, that was it. Yep. Tales from the Dark Side.
It is in Tales, yeah, from the Dark Side.
Yeah, it was James Remar.
Yep. That's the first time I saw that story as well. Like, I'm watching Quaidan and I'm like, hold on a second. Like, is this that gargoyle story with James Remar? I'm like, I know this one.
It is.
So yeah, it's very interesting, and I think other than maybe America and England, Japan is like the country that has the most ghost stories. Like, they really, really love ghosts. I mean, that's Ringu and Ju-on and Dark Water. Like, those are all very more recent famous ghost stories from Japan. They don't get too much into like the other things. Like, they occasionally you'll get, you know, zombie ass or whatever. You get the random zombie movie from Japan, but they do a lot of they love ghost stories over there.
Oh yeah, we talked about like repression, and the Japanese culture is a very repressed culture until suddenly like it all comes out. And I feel like this film is definitely dealing with that repression in a way, but then you'll get like the repression coming out in films like Zombie Ass.
Literally.
Yeah, literally, where I feel like someone just had to get their weird shit out and they're like, I'm going to make this fucking movie. And that's how we got Zombie Ass.
Repressed is a really good definition of the Japanese people. That is 100% what they are. They take everything out in their art 100%. They are like super nice, super polite, and they're like, listen, here's what's going on deep inside of me. That's it. But I mean, even you can even see the influences, like you brought up Audition, possibly doing that eventually. And I feel like this seems very influential to Audition. I mean, obviously there's a couple decades and probably other films in there that affected it, but it feels like another step in the evolution.
Oh yeah, for sure. And Audition was another one that, I mean, I'll talk that movie up to, you know, anyone when they ask me like favorite horror films, but I feel like Audition is a lot like this, where you should absolutely go into that movie as cold as possible. Cause a lot like this, Audition takes a lot of twists and turns that, that will really surprise you.
Yeah, and it would be nice if you could go into any of these movies not knowing they're going to be a horror film. Like, I think that would be, like, how's your tolerance? What can and can't you handle? Let's just pretend this is a drama, okay?
Yeah, like, Audition, you know, I wouldn't know it was a horror film, but for most of the movie, I'm like, where's the horror coming from? And
then at the end, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I was like, oh, okay, that's where it came. And it was the same with this one, where I'm like, all right, you know, so what's going to happen here? And then it happens, and I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, obviously it didn't affect me like Audition did, but...
Well, there's a lot of, like, surprise and jump scares in Onibaba, but Audition has, like, something like Saw-esque where it's just hard to watch. Yeah. And I'm like, oh man, like it's like one of the few things that like I just don't handle it too well. And I think I handle most of that torture porn stuff fine.
Yeah, Audition, like I always say it's better than most torture porn, because you know it takes a long time setting up, and it's not horrific until suddenly it is, but also make sure that you really like these characters. So when this shit starts to happen, you really start to feel for them.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that is the structure I prefer in most horror films. Let me really, really like these people and then take them away from me or make them experience terrible things. Or have terrible people experience terrible things, and then I'm rooting for the terrible things to happen to them. It's all about manipulation, people.
Yeah, I agree.
I would say the only thing that I haven't talked about yet is the score, which I will include in this episode so you can hear it.
Yeah, I wanted, I wanted to get into that, too.
It's just this great, uncomfortable... like tribal drum kind of music.
I especially love like the law of it is like this tribal drum, and then all of a sudden it's just like a guy going like, eh! It's like it reminds me of the scene in Shaun of the Dead where they're drunk and the zombies are back, and they're like, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. You know,
there you go, you nailed it. I did.
Yep. You don't have to listen to the score anymore. I just did it for you.
You got that Easter egg. You knew that Shaun of the Dead has clearly seen Onibaba, and that's what they were going for.
Maybe. I don't want to, you know, put money on that, but it certainly seems it.
It's one of the few scores where it's like, I don't know, if I listen to it by itself, which you kind of have heard already at this point, a little uncomfortable, a little creepy, but it works so well with the atmosphere in this movie that it's something that I don't, it kind of is like the Psycho theme or something. It only works in that movie.
Yeah.
Are you still with us, Chuck?
I'm here. I'm here.
Okay.
I think that's another, I think the, that might just be an off-putting thing too, just because using like traditional Japanese instruments and using like Eastern scales just don't sound, I think it's not a thing that like a lot of people think of, that a lot of our Western music is based on very specific scales, like major and minor, that are completely different in the Middle East and Asia. So they, those sounds just come off, I think, off-putting, even if they were, even if you were trying to put a, put like a comedy music together with like with those type of instruments. I always get that with like that little string thing. I think it's a biwa, that the one, some of the people, I think it's like what Zatoichi plays, and that thing, and like people will be like, it's so beautiful, and like, but to most people, I think that the listen to like guitar and piano and violin, like if you heard that thing play, some people would be like, oh, that was the most horrendous thing I've ever heard. It just sounded like you were smacking you know, bed springs together on a board. Like it's just an off-putting sound to begin with, but then when you pair it with the visuals of Onibaba, it makes it like even more creepy and weird.
Well, you have like, I mean, when you think about horror scores, where you're talking about, let's transform something that's normally not creepy, John Carpenter on a piano with Halloween, or then you have things where several years later It Follows, and you listen to that by itself, and it's just like eerie atmosphere gibberish, but in the movie it's like timed perfectly to keep fucking with you. And I think that Onibaba's score is more in line with that. It's like, it's what is there to make you uncomfortable. And it's happening early on in the movie where it's not necessarily even shot like a horror film. It's just this uncomfortableness between these people, like a calm before the storm or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the music's like, times are about to get rough.
Yeah.
But final thoughts?
Go James.
Go James, go.
Yeah, I mean, I stand by what I said, even though it makes no sense after listening to a podcast. See this movie as cold as possible. It's still really good, incredibly haunting. It feels timeless. It doesn't feel like a movie that came out in the early 60s. I feel like this movie could come out like, you know, next month and it would still feel just as fresh. And lots of fun, lots of great twists and turns and great atmosphere. Yeah, I'd say see it.
I would agree. I think it holds up really well. I think just because I'd watch this and Kuroniko together. They do go really hand in hand perfectly. The visuals on them are both really great. Like, I think, I don't know, out of all the films I've seen in black and white, these are like probably two of the best looking ones, because they use light and shadow perfectly to hide things really well. It starts getting like hallucinatory, where things just kind of like blend in and out of the background, just really well thought out and well done. And yeah, go watch more Japanese horror. We'll talk about it eventually. I know me and Justin love this movie. We'll talk about House eventually, because I still believe that's the greatest Japanese horror film of all time. Maybe even one of the best horror films of all time.
I need to see this one now.
Need to see this.
I'm interested in what James thinks after he watches that movie. My thoughts on this film are, I'll riff off of you guys a little bit. Going into it blind is probably the best way to go into it. With like how James said, I agree with him on that. welcome to the end of the podcast where you're hearing that now. I think we talked about it a little bit in the middle. And Chuck brought up a really cool point about the atmosphere tone of the lighting, just the black and white. It like progresses. It gets darker as the film goes along. It starts pretty much the first half is completely in daylight. And by the second half, it complete darkness. And I'm sure that is quite intentional. But I saw this movie on it's on Criterion DVD. I watched it on the Criterion channel because I'm holding out for Blu-ray someday. Where did you guys all watch it? Do you own it?
I do not. It's first time I saw it, I got it from the library, which, you know, I've been on this for a while that your local library is a great resource, but it's on HBO Max for if you have it. It's under their TCM tab, which has a great selection of films. Just for anyone, really.
I just had it. I had the DVD from a Criterion sale at Barnes & Noble. It's the same. I had Kuroniko, too, from like a Barnes & Noble sale a long time ago. I think I just bought them separately and never noticed until now that they were the same director, but I've had both of them.
Aren't they like close to the same year? Aren't they close to coming out at the same time?
64 for Onibaba, 68 for Kuroniko.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's a wonderful film. I really think if you're looking for something new and you like horror, this is definitely, hopefully that's what this whole theme ends up doing for you. But Onibaba is something that took me a really long time to watch for some reason. I think I watched it for the first time last year, and now I've seen it three or four times, and I love it. I definitely think that there's way more to talk about than we probably even touched on. Somebody that's really good into philosophy and psychology can probably go pretty deep down this rabbit hole,
yeah,
and have something interesting to say. But yeah, I feel like if I was a smarter person, we could be talking for 2 hours. I think I could. I just don't really go to bore people to death. Or if people want to get bored to death, maybe we'll do Onibaba, the remix extended edition. And we'll go hard and just hard into it. We'll do 4-hour episode.
A deep dive into Onibaba.
Yeah.
Like those YouTube videos.
It'll be called Onibaba Explained. Which, for the record, is one of my least favorite things, especially for things that don't need explained. I mean, I'm thinking of YouTube videos. I can understand possibly Inception ending explained. Somebody's like, I don't know if I got it. But then some things are so simple. It's like Aladdin explained. And I'm like, what the fuck needed explained in that movie?
Yeah, I'll see that for literally every movie. And I'm like, not all of these movies have ambiguous endings. Most of these films have pretty definitive endings. You know, we don't need you to explain them to us, but, you know.
I mean, I do like to mull on a film for a little bit in my head and think of how I consider it. And then I'll start reading some things or watching some things and seeing what other people thought. I don't like to do it too much before I talk about a movie, though, because then I'm like, when I'm watching those things or reading those things, I'm like, yeah, that's what I think. And I feel like I completely lost my own thought by the end. And I'm like, yeah, it's what all these other people said. Here, let me tell you what they said. But yeah, it's the ghost story with no ghosts, in my opinion. And I would consider it one of Japan's best horror films. House is interesting. I don't know if it's entirely horror. It kind of goes into comedy a little bit.
Hey, the best horror movies do.
Okay. I agree somewhat.
Yeah.
I do. But that is our show. And you're going to get several more, 5 more of these international horrors, if my math is right. But
I'm just going to throw out, I don't think your math is correct.
It isn't? There's not 7, there's 6?
Shit, no, you're right. I'm wrong.
Okay.
Now everyone knows I'm an idiot.
Chuck can't count to 7.
Well, yeah.
None. I taunt him like a child on the podcast.
Nonetheless, we have a lot.
Yeah. I am on Twitter at JJMorgan19. Follow me there. Chuck?
ChuckFinn66. Don't follow me because I don't do anything.
He really doesn't. James?
I'm at James Reinhardt.
On Twitter, we're at CinemaDamore, /CinemaDamore on Facebook. That's where you follow us, and we have great art that lets you know what episode's coming out on Friday. Usually just the day before, Thursday, it's like, hey, guess what we're doing tomorrow? Anibaba.
Shit.
Yeah. That's our model. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, iHeartRadio. I don't know. Probably AM radio somewhere. I have no idea.
We're
lots
everywhere.
Of places. We kind of are. I want to know. Nobody ever answers questions when I ask them on the podcast, but I want to know where the most obscure places that you listen to podcasts. And are you listening to our podcast there? And if not, I will get us there. That's my promise to you listeners.
Yeah, I'm very curious to hear where y'all listen to us. We could look at this. We could see the the statistics, but
it's probably other.
I like hearing it from people.
Maybe reach out on our social media, Facebook or Twitter. We'll definitely see it there. If you're responding on the obscure podcast service, we might never read it.
That is true.
That'd be horrible. Yeah. That'd be horrifying if we just ended up finding some weird thing and there was just some weird cult following.
like on some third rate hosting site.
Like, I know Justin says he hates the sound of his voice, but that's all I'm listening for. I don't even know what the hell they're talking about, but that voice, that's why I tune in.
They just like hearing the sound of our voice.
Yeah. But anyways, we'll be back next week. Chuck's hosting. Spain is the country. If you want to take a guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of people, when they think of Spanish horror, they're probably actually thinking of movies from Mexico, like Guillermo del Toro. I don't know that there's not necessarily a wide Spanish, as in movies from Spain, horror following, I guess. So hopefully we can educate some people.
I love your emphasis. Or you have Mexican films like Pan's Labyrinth that takes place in Spain.
Yeah, but it's not really a Spanish film. It's still a Mexican film.
I wouldn't consider it a Spanish film. I would consider it in the Spanish language.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's a Spanish language film, but it's not a Spanish film.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
I agree. But thank you, everybody, for listening. We appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Thanks.